Bil-semmija ta' kempus FM, Emanuel Buttigieġ u li jimgawċi jilħawkom għal-episodju jħor ta' taħdita kliju. Ikkontu malna ġemal oħra, ta' fu l-bdejna nitkellmu dwar Malta Rumani, użmin il-Rumani f'Malta, u ħankomplu din id-diskussjoni jiena u liem flimkien mal-mistiedna tagħna li reġgħu kellhom il-pjaċir ikunu magħna, Dr. Maxine Anastasi u David Cardona. Għadarba provajna natuna għastampa ġenerali, kif beda, kif spiċċa, u daċxiex ġarra in-between. Saħan nitlu daċxiex iktar fil-font ta' ċertu aspetti u xek li. Forsi nibdew bil-mistoqsija, what were the Romans doing in Malta? X'kien għawa day, what was happening on a day-to-day basis, so to say, as far as we can tell?
Well, I think it's also make perhaps something important to note that the Romans sort of didn't repopulate Malta. So Malta was still, if we refer to last week's episode where sort of we said that the culture, the mm-hmm. inhabitants were Punic, at least mm-hmm. they were descendants from the Punic and Carthaginian. So by that time they're actually inhabitants of Malta. And they were doing pretty much what they had done before. Most of these people during the Roman period continued to work in agriculture, mm-hmm. primarily, probably construction.
So, I've always wanted to ask this on air. What did the Romans do for us?
So original.
we have a lot of influence from the Romans. We see primarily the most... the one that we can see most evidently is architecture, for example, where we see standardization of buildings, we see the introduction of the classical orders of architecture, other than the Doric.
The arch,
the concrete, of which we have evidence on the Maltese island. So
today's buildings have all of concrete, have a good connection to Rome.
Well, you can say that because there was a gap.
We've got a lot of contractors who are obsessed with Rome then.
We can call them Romans. But we do see quite a lot of work being done architecturally on the Maltese islands during the Roman period.
What fascinates me is this idea, but again, maybe you'll destroy it too.
Just like the Vomitarium.
Imdina Melite was the main town. And apparently it was much larger than the walled enclosure we see today. That basically what is Rabat, much of it was within the walls of Melite, of ancient Imdina. Is that really the case? And what do we know of that?
Well, technically, there is ongoing research, of course, so this is an evolving picture. Yeah. But we know that probably even in the Punic period, at least in the late Punic period, the main town, Melite, extended up to the St. Paul's Church in Rabat today. Mm. In fact, St. Paul's Church is built above a ditch.
Right.
A huge ditch, more than 10 meters wide, that we believe was dug up in the Punic period or the early Roman period. So that it's defining the limit of the town. Mm-hmm. Okay, but there were new research showing that the town shrank and grew in different periods.
Over
700 uh-huh. years. For example, it is believed that the top part where Imdina is today was surrounded by a second line of wall, probably in the later Roman period already. So we are seeing a fluctuating area for the town. But it is very interesting that you can then literally see a dividing line between the town of the living and the town of the dead, even in the ditch itself.
In what sense?
Roman law, but even... this is something that was also practiced in the Punic period. We attribute it to the Romans, but it was also practiced during the Punic period. It was prohibited to bury your dead in the city, in the town. So we see a dividing line, literally the ditch is acting as a dividing line between the place of the living and place of the dead. Even the ditch itself, if there's only a small stretch of the ditch surviving and accessible, but if you see the town site, it contains caves, probably used for as workshops and habitation, whatever. But on the farthest end, you can already start seeing small hypogea and small tombs being dug up, even in the ditch itself. So there's a clear demarcation line between the city of the dead and the city of the living. What the Romans did was they put it in writing that you cannot really bury within the town. But it was something that was already available.
So approaching the town, you would have been going through a large-scale cemetery of some sort.
The Romans, one of the ways in which the Romans measured the importance of the family, because it was all about the family, was on how prominent, for example, and how close to the road the mausoleum and the tomb was to the road. So they acted as social parameters, literally. So burials were social places, and they directly affected the importance of the family.
I see. Wow. It's a very, very different conception to us.
So we're talking about the city. We're talking about commerce. So this city should have been important or had a certain amount of importance, let's say, for Mozart surely, but in the Roman world. What was the commerce? How was money made? What was...
Well, as I had mentioned earlier, most of the people would have been involved in agriculture at this time. So food production, making wine, those were really sort of primary
Honey products. Production, is that something?
That is sort of a... We suspect that it's not unlike that honey would have probably been produced, but there is a mistranslation.
I was going to go for a myth debunking here. Melita and honey and Melit coming from honey.
In the few literary sources that we have, where it's not actually specific that it's honey from Malta. And it has been sort of misread or misinterpreted.
Manuel, I love my colleagues. Yes, tell us more about this. How wrong are we when we're saying, oh, come, we love Malta, we have the best honey in the world, even the Romans said it. It's wrong, right?
We just don't have the evidence. We don't have the literary evidence for it. Yes. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if honey was being produced. We just don't have sort of the hard
direct connection.
It's not that core that we were taught.
No.
Okay.
Although we do have a lot of literary evidence, and actually this is where sort of the literary evidence is stronger than the archaeological for things like textiles. And from their importance, especially in Cicero's sort of witness accounts and testimonials.
The speech that I read out last week, the reference to Verres establishing a factory for females.
Exactly.
Very specific as well.
So our primary source for a textile industry and the Maltese inhabitants sort of making world-renowned, or at least Mediterranean-renowned textiles, comes from the literary sources. Unfortunately, textiles themselves don't survive very well in the archaeological record or in a place like Malta. So,
but would you find, let's call it machinery or things that indicate this kind of production happening?
We have loom weights, quite a few of which were discovered in the what we call the back remains of the domus. So behind the domus, there are the remains of later houses, smaller houses, in which Zamit documents the discovery of quite a number, Temizamit.
I want to talk to you about the Roman domus, but just before that, who was Verres?
So he was a Sicilian, or he was appointed Sicilian governor of the province of Sicily. But apparently he was a very sort of crooked, corrupt governor who just exploited the Sicilians, and
the poor Maltese were so Puritan that he took advantage of them, and as always, the foreigner destroys our lovely country.
We have to remember that Malta was part of the province of Sicily in the Roman period, so they're quite connected to each other.
So we've mentioned the domus, and that's what I'd like to hear a bit more now about. As a child, to me it was always described as the villa, and that's how we know. But a few years ago, you people decided to start calling it the domus, the house. You destroyed another myth.
So we've destroyed the vomitarium, honey, and now the villa.
What happened? I mean, what has changed in our understanding that made, I mean, we're joking, obviously, the professionals say this is not a villa, this is a house.
Well, technically it's the term. In modern terms, a domus is technically a townhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the villa is normally a house outside of the city walls.
Right.
And the ruins of the Domus Romana are close to the Acropolis, so it's quite in a prominent part of the town, next probably to the fortification line. So it we cannot really, technically, in simple terms, call it a villa, because we'd be wrong. So it's all
in the terminology. It's a house in the town.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, in my mind, a villa was also a unit of production, that's why it's outside, whereas the house is more just a unit of consumption. Is that the case here?
Yeah, you could have both together as well.
Even so, in the town.
So remember that, let's talk about a town, a structure in the town first. The structure in the towns, especially if belonging to someone from the elite, was not just a place where to live, but it was a public place. It was sometimes referred to as more public than private.
You have guests coming in, we mentioned them last week, we're having feasts, we're having dinners, the entertainment.
Yeah, and it was all part of the economical and financial and political influencing system.
What do we have in the Roman Domus? What is unique about it? Why is it this important for Roman Malta?
But what we have there are the remains of an evolving house. So we know that the house was originally a bit smaller. But then at a later stage, it was enlarged to incorporate the peristyle, which is the most famous part of the house. So the peristyle is an internal courtyard with the Doric columns.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're using Doric columns here again.
We're using that, and I'll come to that later. So we're seeing a population, at least the elite, that are changing their style of the house, the plan of the house, to reflect somewhat the Roman structure. And the Romans try to use the rooms, at least the front parts of the house, in a visual manner. So they use the architecture and the decoration visually, and that's why all the rooms were literally normally at a line, straight line of sight. So they're making use of the peristyle and the colonnade as a backdrop to the owner of the house every morning, for example, or when visitors come in. But at the same time, we're also seeing the traditional aspect, because the Doric was not that it was liked in the Roman period, but eventually was changed into the Corinthian normally abroad. Whereas in Malta, in the private sphere, we see the continuation of the Doric that was probably brought in Malta in the Hellenistic period, so technically in the Punic period, and continues in the Roman period throughout in private houses. So we're seeing changing. Some styles are changing to be in line, more in line with the Roman period, whereas there is still some sense of traditionalism.
Rather archaic, possibly. But is it a reflection of an insular society, or being far away from the center, which is Rome, or am I totally wrong? As I see, Dr. Anastasi going.
there can be various interpretations, and of course everyone interprets them differently. For me, it's more a sense of traditionalistic movement. Where people are, they're getting in line with some of the Roman traditions, but they're still keeping their own traditions.
Hmm.
Because when it comes to public buildings, for example, then in the second and second centuries AD, we see a complete shift from local stone and Doric to marble and Corinthian. Hmm. So
the Roman villa, domus. What is the time frames that we can give it for its use?
Well, from the mosaic, we can say that at least the last phase was probably constructed between the end of the first century BC and the start of the first century AD. So we see that 100-year gap, and this is also then we know it continued well in the middle of the first century AD through these statues it has. Emperor Claudius is represented.
Yes.
Possibly a young Nero, one of Claudius's daughters. So we know it continued to be used.
Fantastic. You mentioned earlier that it was close to the Acropolis. Now, what is the Acropolis, and roughly where do you think it was then?
Well, the Acropolis is normally a term for the highest part of the town, and that's where most of the prominent temples would have been, and most the prominent public buildings, administrative buildings would have been. Of course, today the Acropolis is occupied by Mdina, so it's very difficult for us to identify what structures were actually on. We know, for example, through inscriptions there was a temple for Apollo, or, but we know very little else. There is some evidence that there was quite substantial structures around the Benedictine monastery and Kazanguanets, where even up to the 1800s, 1700s, there were quite a few marble pieces, architecture pieces lying around. So it must have been, there must have been an important building, but it's, we know very, very little of it.
And also that it was bounded by a wall.
By a wall, yeah.
We find traces.
Yeah. The Acropolis itself.
Yeah.
Still in places around Mdina, and people can still see some of them.
Uh-huh.
Sort of very, very large
blocks
of stone. We call them ashlar masonry. And these are quite sort of typical of sort of Punic and Roman sized masonry and construction.
If we leave the town and the domus and we go to these villas that dot the countryside, there seem to have been a few of them at least around. What can you tell us about these?
So, sort of, they're actually quite, we've probably got records now. We suspect, we know of at least 24,
really?
25.
Wow.
And
I thought you were going to say 10.
And sort of we're optimistic that more can be discovered. There are different types of villas and sort of what we would consider, and they equate to really sort of luxury residences. So one of the very famous ones is in Gozo, near Ramla Hamra. And that was a sort of what we call a maritime villa, probably belonged to someone quite wealthy. Had marble floors and also had its own bath complex.
Wow.
So one of the things that actually I remember a professor telling me that what made Romans or what Romans needed were baths and wine.
Okay.
So,
so they had that.
We also then see quite a lot of more industrial villas, which are really farmsteads where you have places that people reside in, but also areas dedicated to agricultural production, perhaps animal rearing. And one of the most sort of distinctive features of a lot of these rural villas are areas reserved for the pressing of olive oil. And we're quite fortunate in, so we have remains which are very typical and point directly to this source of pressing. So we have anchor blocks, which we call counterweight blocks, which were used to hold down the pressing beam. We find limestone rotary mills called, we call trapeta, and those were used to crush the olives before they were placed in a basket to be pressed, and then oil would have been derived. So we have quite a lot, actually, of these villas.
Who's doing the work? I mean, Rome was an empire of slaves. Do we have evidence of who are the working people, of slavery in these years? In these
he always comes up with the difficult questions.
Archaeologically, we have very, very little about slaves in Malta. One possible indication could be a circular disc found at the Silge by the Missione, with an imprint of a child's hand on it. That could be indicative of a slave, but we have very, very, very little, especially because very rarely we find a complete house. So slaves normally lived in their own quarters within the house, but we rarely find the whole building. So it's very difficult for us to identify which room is which.
And we find it several centuries after it's been abandoned.
Quarried away.
In Pompeii, there are some very clear examples of quarters that were the slaves' quarters. But we don't have the equivalent, it seems, here.
Pompeii is a fantastic source for archaeologists, at least, of sort of Roman living. But sadly, it's quite sort of difficult to find that equivalent.
Yes. You need a good volcano for that.
We need a good volcano, yeah, which we don't have, fortunately. But I think a lot of evidence which we lack archaeologically in a place like Malta, which has high humidity, and is organic materials. And a place like Pompeii sort of provides us with some incredible information.
Insights, yeah.
About sort of what seeds people had even in their bowel movements. So people have studied sewers, mm-hmm. the remains in sewers, and been able to even track that to which house the remains came from. So that level of information, which would help in determining who might have been less well off, who had poor nutrition.
In both Rome and Pompeii, there is evidence of what we would call sort of blocks of flats.
Mm-hmm. You know,
any sense of something like that in Melite?
Not at the moment.
No.
Not at the moment. We have the humble houses, as we said, behind the domus, which seem to be humbler. Of course, we're only seeing the foundations of the houses, so we don't know how high they were.
I see.
Uh-huh. And apart from that, we have the remains in the car park just in front of the Domus Romana, where there were also the remains of some houses along the road, but we cannot really tell. The only evidence of a second floor in Malta comes from the Villa of Cacciatura, so where we have the remains of a stairway.
Oh, wow.
Otherwise, most of the stone would have been carted away for reuse.
Gozo, we mentioned the Roman villa in Ramla al-Hamra, but what was happening in Gozo during this period?
So it was. It's almost an autonomous island as well. It had its own central.
Yes, this is the partial center, probably.
Well, at a certain point in time, it also minted its own coins.
But everyone was minting coins, weren't they?
We believe it had its own government setup or municipium, as we call it, at least in part of the occupation. So we're probably seeing two islands that are working together, but in a sense autonomous.
So there is a form of, I'd use the word self-government, but I don't want to push it too much. So how does government work in this, 700 years? I'm sure it varied, but what's the general picture?
It's as you said, it's varying a lot, but we believe at some points in time there was a representative of the emperor. So, for example, we have an inscription that is mentioning someone who's representing Augustus, that is the emperor. Mm-hmm. In other instances, we have mention of a municipium and the protos of the municipium or of the town. And we suspect that is a small council, literally, that is actually managing and administering the town on behalf always of the emperor.
Mm.
So there's always this link with the emperor and Rome. That was never lost. So,
okay, as we're approaching the end of this episode, more general question. Where is the study of Rome going these days, both locally and internationally? What are the exciting things, as it were?
I love the reaction of our guests.
Well, archaeology in Malta, the Roman archaeology in Malta, has always, unfortunately, been overshadowed with the prehistoric archaeology.
Uh-huh.
Of course, we have the famous temples, the structures.
The glamour is with prehistory.
That yes. Provide a lot of glamour to archaeologists and to the island. So it's an iconic.
Friends in Scandinavia who complain that everything is about the Vikings.
Luckily, through collaborations even between the local entities, Heritage Malta superintendents and the university, we've seen quite a lot of work being carried out in the last 10 years. There has always been also been a large input from foreign institutions like the Missione Archeologica Italiana, and we are starting new collaborations with new other foreign institutions to investigate what we call a virgin ground, so grounds that have been untouched by new buildings. For example, we have quite a big project next to the Domus Romana starting this summer, which we hope that will provide us with valuable data about the understanding and the different phases of archaeology.
I mean, that in itself is impressive, that in such a small place with such density, there can be virgin ground almost, isn't it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. We're very lucky that it's government property, so it's easier to do. Uh-huh. But we can literally find remains even under existing houses. So
yes.
There's always something to discover.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We also have a lot of...
Your turn. What's next?
No, we also have a lot of backlog of material culture as well, which is something that I tend to
shelves
focus
and
on.
Shelves of pottery.
Of pottery. And that tells us very valuable information and complements sort of the excavation and sort of surveying of new works, because it provides dates and...
We're putting together this jigsaw puzzle. And I think all these, as David said, all these experts coming together from all over the world and also locally, I think we're getting to a point that we have so many new colors to see with regards to this period, and it's so exciting.
It is very.
And
yeah.
It's so exciting that we still have another program together planned for next week. And I would like to invite the listeners to be back here at the same time, at the same place, and we'll continue talking about Roman Malta next week. Thank you.